Southern Fried True Crime covers cases that are not suitable for young listeners, and there may also be some explicit language used. Listener discretion is advised. Not really sure why I waited so long. That was posted on Emma Jane Walker's Twitter account on November 13th, 2016, just 5 days before she was murdered by her ex-boyfriend. Emma was a victim of intimate partner violence, better known as domestic violence, but that still doesn't accurately describe what happened to Emma. She was actually a victim of coercive control, which is a building block of domestic violence, an early indicator of escalating abuse. And it is just as dangerous to a woman's mental health as physical abuse. We also know that separation is the most dangerous time for an abused woman. And it takes on average 7 times to leave an abuser. Emma had broken up with her boyfriend Riley many times. She fits the profile, and so does he. The main difference here is that Emma was 16 years old. Coercive control in teen relationships is much more prevalent than physical abuse. That's because it's the starting point. Young girls are not as equipped as mature women to see these signs, though many adult women also miss the importance of this first part of abuse until they are in the insidious midst of it. Understanding coercive control and domestic abuse in teenage relationships is so important. Not only to protect our teens, but to start changing the culture. Sadly, Emma's parents did see the signs and did everything right, but even their careful vigilance could not save their daughter. Welcome to episode 76, Coercive Control and Teen Domestic Violence, The Murder of Emma Jane Walker. Emma Jane Walker was born on March 20, 2000, in Knoxville, Tennessee, to parents Jill and Mark. Knoxville is nestled in the Tennessee Valley of the Appalachian Mountains. The city was named after Henry Knox, the first Secretary of War for the United States. Although Knoxville and Memphis are both in Tennessee, they aren't neighbors. You could almost drive to Atlanta and back in the time it takes to drive from Memphis to Knoxville. Knoxville is the home of the flagship campus of the University of Tennessee, the site of the 1982 World's Fair, the headquarters for the Tennessee Valley Authority, and the first state capital of Tennessee. Knoxville is also the largest city in East Tennessee, and the third largest in the state after Nashville and Memphis, and the city's nicknames include K-Town, Knox Vegas, Marble City, and Scruffy City. I also saw where it was called Streaker City because evidently, there was a bunch of that going on in the 70s there at sporting events. Speaking of sports, the fans for the Knoxville UT Vols are one of a kind. The team has been struggling for years, but their fan base is loyal and extremely vocal. The tailgating parties are epic, and being inside Neyland Stadium is practically a religious experience for many diehard fans. The average crowd turnout is around 80,000. But that's actually down because of the last few poor seasons. They used to sell out the stadium every game, but they haven't done that since September 2017 against the Georgia Bulldogs, where they got creamed 41-0. But the Vols have won 6 national championships and remain in the hearts of many Tennesseans, including my poor husband, who continues to get his heart broken every time they lose. And by broken heart, I mean there's quite a bit of cussing in my house on the days that the Vols lose. But Knoxville, a diverse and vibrant city, is so much more than the Vols. It has a distinguished and storied history of all kinds of music, particularly jazz, blues, and rock and roll. Elvis Presley's career took off in Knoxville when a local record company executive heard his single on the radio and signed him to a contract. It is also known as the cradle of country music. If you visit Knoxville, there is a free downtown self-guided walking tour explaining Knoxville's ties to country music icons like Hank Williams, the Everly Brothers, Dolly Parton, and Roy Acuff. Knoxville's Gay Street is infamous for many reasons. It runs through a vibrant downtown that features historic theaters, museums, parks, galleries, shops, rooftop bars, and some 75 restaurants, all within 1 square mile. Several of these buildings are listed on the National Register of Historic Places. During the Civil War, then Vice President Andrew Johnson was shot at while giving a speech on Gay Street. And then years later, there was a hotel named for him. Hank Williams spent his last night there on New Year's Eve 1952. At only 30 years old, his official cause of death was a heart attack, brought on by a lethal combination of alcohol, morphine, and chloral hydrate. In the late 1930s, Knoxville's first radio station, WNOX, was located in the Andrew Johnson Building. It provided jobs to struggling artists as studio players and helped give rise to country music. That may surprise some country music fans, as Nashville is known as the home of country music. But Roy Acuff's first performance was in the Tennessee Theater on Gay Street. He went on to audition for the Grand Ole Opry in Nashville, becoming the Opry's number one star, where he became known as the King of Country Music. On the opposite end of Gay Street, another country music station opened in 1953 called WIVK, where the queen, goddess, and angel on earth, Dolly Parton, got her start at age 7. She sang on her Uncle Bill Owens' program, and by age 10, she was a regular. She made her Opry debut at age 13. And now, she is a global icon like none other. It's not just her talent or her generosity, but her love and open-mindedness for everyone. She has been a gay icon for decades for her unapologetic support of the LGBTQ community, long before other celebrities became advocates, and certainly before it was politically correct. Anyone who knows me knows how much I love Dolly. There is a great joke that the only bipartisan thing in Tennessee is that if you say one bad word about Dolly Parton, the entire state will fight you. If you haven't checked out the podcast, Dolly Parton's America, I highly recommend it. The origins of this remarkable woman and her influence on our culture are so fascinating. And on that note, I'm going to pause for a commercial break, but not before I tell you Mountain Dew addicts that you also have Knoxville to thank. It was first created there in 1940. So go pour you one, and I'll be right back. As I said, Emma was born in Knoxville to a loving family in March of 2000. Her parents, Jill and Mark, adored their little girl, and she also had a brother named Evan. Emma and Evan. That detail especially tugs at my heart, as my family also has a tradition with E names. Emma is always described as a beautiful person with a caring soul, and she was indeed a gorgeous girl. The blonde-haired, blue-eyed girl was also known affectionately as sarcastic and as a bit of a hardhead. Her mother described her spunky sense of humor as something people really didn't get until they got to know her. And to know her was to love her. She had so many friends. At the time of her death, she was a junior at Central High School in Knoxville. She was a cheerleader, an honor student, and was a member of several high-achieving clubs like the Beta Club and Young Life, and also HOSA, the Health Occupation Students of America Club. Strong-willed, smart, and hardworking Emma had already decided what she wanted to do with her life at such a young age. She wanted to become a NICU nurse. She wanted to care for premature and sick newborns. That's a nursing job with a lot of heartbreak, along with the joy of caring for babies. Not everyone can do it, but Emma was determined she would. But she was also still a 16-year-old girl. Looking through her Twitter account, you'll see an effusive girl who loved the beach, going to concerts, hanging out with her friends, and of course, cheerleading. In 2014, when Emma was a freshman, she met a junior football player named Riley Gall. This was early puppy love for someone Emma's age, so her parents let Riley come over while they supervised. And Emma and Riley were also allowed to go out to eat after football games. William Riley Gall was born on August 12, 1998. He was raised by his mother and grandparents. Riley didn't have the stereotypical reputation of a jock that you might expect. He was often described as a bit nerdy, perhaps because of his love of video games, but was also known as a jokester. He had many friends too. While at Central High School, Riley played as a wide receiver and was a top student. After graduation, he went to Merrillville College, about a half hour from Knoxville, where he still played football as a wide receiver. And for those of you keeping score, Merrillville is spelled Maryville, but that's not how we say it. In the beginning, Riley made a good impression on Emma's parents, Jill and Mark, who thought he was very nice, polite, and well-mannered. Just your average boy next door. Soon, Emma's Twitter account was filled with pictures of the cute couple, paddleboarding together, embracing, and taking lots of selfies. On May 30th, 2016, Emma posted four pictures of her and Riley with the caption, "Look how lucky I am." And Emma's friends believe she was happy in the beginning of her relationship with Riley. They say their relationship was normal in the beginning. Riley didn't really talk to Emma's friends, but they weren't initially concerned because they thought he was just shy. One of Emma's friends later said, quote, "From the outside looking in, you'd think he was just a normal guy." But her friends soon noticed something was off. Riley became very controlling over Emma. He didn't want her to hang out with anyone but him. And as Emma pushed back at his behavior, her friends say he only got more possessive and clingy. We know this is how coercive control starts. You alienate her from her friends. You dominate all of her time. And their friends notice that their arguments were becoming really dramatic, mainly through text and Snapchat. Because the relationship was so turbulent, they dated on and off for 2 years, with Emma often breaking up with Riley, only to take him back. Her mother, Jill, noticed Riley's behavior. It irked her when Emma told her mom that Riley told her what she should or shouldn't wear. Emma had always been her own person, with her own style. This was concerning, and Jill was not blind to it. She talked to her daughter about it and tried to explain how his controlling behavior was affecting Emma. Emma's friends also tried to talk to her about it, but said she often brushed them off. Jill told ABC News, quote, "But as you do that with a teenager, the more you butt heads, the more she is going to think he is in the right, because he had a way of isolating her and making her think he was the only one." Emma thought she was in love with Riley, and at this point, it probably felt like a Romeo and Juliet situation. That happens a lot with teenage love. If a parent tries to break up the relationship, it pushes them closer. Emma probably thought her parents just didn't understand. And like most abusers, after Riley treated her badly, he always apologized and said lovely things to her like, "I love you more than words can describe." It's a pattern we see a lot in domestic violence situations. Though there is no evidence that Riley was physically violent with Emma, he was just obsessed with her and easily angered if she didn't jump to his beck and call. And then Riley began escalating. Emma had a job at a grocery store, and he would wait outside for her for hours. He became even more aggressive towards Emma, sending her messages saying things like, "I hate you. I hate everything about you. You're the biggest bitch I've ever come in contact with." He was wearing down her self-esteem, another tenet of coercive control. And the messages just kept getting worse. One read, quote, "You're dead to me. I'll check the obituary. Fuck you." Of course, he would always apologize, but Emma's parents weren't stupid. They checked her phone, and they saw the "dead to me" text. Jill and Mark actually confronted Riley about it. He said he was just angry and hadn't meant it, but they didn't believe him. There were more and more red flags, and they had finally had enough. They told Riley he was no longer welcome at their home. He was not allowed in the house anymore, and they told Emma she should break up with Riley for good. But that didn't work. So they took away her cell phone so she couldn't talk to Riley. But Riley gave Emma an iPod Touch so that she could still text him on it when she was on Wi-Fi. He would also sneak into Emma's room through her bedroom window at night. Many of Emma's tweets about Riley were really sweet, and often it was just a cute picture of the couple. But some tweets were more vague and becoming darker, like the one I told you about in the beginning when she tweeted, "Not really sure why I waited so long." About 2 weeks before Emma's murder, Riley tweeted, "I'd do anything to have it all back." In the fall of 2016, 18-year-old Riley was a freshman in college, and Emma was a junior in high school. Despite the drama, on social media and off, they were still dating, though it was now more of an on-and-off relationship. Around Halloween of 2016, Emma's parents decided to ground her. She could only leave the house to go to school, work, and cheerleading practice. They monitored everywhere she went. I'm sure this was hard for Mark and Jill. Emma had always been a responsible and hardworking girl, but it was for her own safety. They were now convinced Riley was toxic and possibly dangerous, and they thought it seemed to be working. Emma's father said, quote, "She did become like her old self again. She would come out of her room, eat dinner with us, and socialize with us." Emma had even texted a friend and told her that she and Riley were done for good. Naturally, Riley didn't want the relationship to end. He took an overdose of Vicodin pills and drank alcohol, attempting suicide, or at least trying to make it look like a suicide attempt to get Emma's sympathy. It didn't work. For the next couple of weeks, Riley's friends noticed his mood swings. They said he often isolated himself, moping, but also talked about how depressed he was and said he wanted to hurt himself. But at this point, Emma really was done. She saw his behavior as manipulative and was not sympathetic. Her parents forcing that separation really did help her gain perspective and see what Riley was doing to her. On November 18th, 2016, 16-year-old Emma was allowed out of the house to go to a party at a friend's house. At around 11:30 p.m., Emma told a guy friend of hers named Zach that she was getting strange text messages from a number she didn't know. The messages said things like, "Come outside alone if you don't want to see a loved one get hurt," and, "I've got someone you love. If you don't comply, I will hurt them." Emma thought the texts were coming from one of Riley's friends, that they were playing a trick on her. Police would later discover that Riley was using an app called Phoner to mask his number. Emma texted back saying she would call the police, but the texts only got more aggressive. One message said, "If you'd like to hear his crying and screams, give me a call. He's in a ditch beside the house. It's a shame you can all of a sudden not value someone's life." Finally, Zach and Emma decided to go outside and check. They found Riley lying face down in a ditch. Riley claimed that he didn't know how he got there, that he'd been kidnapped. He kept saying, "Where am I? How did I get here?" Zach said Riley was holding his head as if he had been hit there. Zach later said Emma was immediately uneasy. But despite this dramatic scene, Emma told Riley they had just broken up and to leave her alone. And at that, Riley got up and took off down the street. He called his friend Noah Walton to say he'd been kidnapped. Noah didn't believe him, but offered to call the police anyway. Riley said he didn't want any police to be involved. So, of course, no one reported the supposed kidnapping because it didn't really happen and no one believed him. On that same day, November 18th, Riley and his grandfather James had switched cars. When Riley returned the car, James realized his gun was missing from under the driver's seat. It's not clear when he realized the gun was missing, but he reported it stolen on November 20th. But on the morning after Riley's fake kidnapping scene, Emma was home alone. It was Saturday, November 19th, and a man dressed all in black came to her door and kept ringing the bell. She said the man was dressed from head to toe in black, including sunglasses, a hood, and a ski mask. Emma texted her friends, "I'm home alone and somebody in all black walked down my street, came to my door, and rang the doorbell over and over again. I thought I was going to die." Emma also texted Riley and said, "I hate you, but I need you right now." Riley replied, "I'm coming. I'm speeding. Just give me a minute." As Riley pulled up, Emma's mother, Jill, was arriving home and saw him in the front yard with her daughter. She told him he knew he wasn't allowed at their home. Riley insisted he was just there to make sure Emma was okay. But Jill asked him to leave, and he did. Emma told her mother what had happened with the guy in black and also about the weird incident with Riley in the ditch the night before. Jill said, "Don't you find it odd that Riley was involved or appeared at both events?" But Emma said it couldn't have been Riley. Even though she had turned a page and understood what he was doing, she didn't think he would go that far. But she was so scared by the incidents that she asked her family to turn on their security system. She had never asked them to do this before. And Riley was still calling and texting her, begging her to respond, but she wouldn't. For the rest of that Saturday, November 19th, Emma's parents watched her to make sure everything was okay. On Sunday, November 20th, Jill and Mark followed Emma to work and back home to make sure nothing happened. On Sunday night, Emma texted a friend about a school assignment and then went to bed around midnight. Jill and Mark Walker were doing everything right. At this point, they didn't have proof that Riley was the guy dressed in black and probably didn't feel that they could report it. So instead, they kept a close watch on their daughter, trying to make sure she was safe. And as long as they had their eyes on her, she was. I'm going to pause now to hear a final word from our sponsors. Orate is fine jewelry made in New York City. It's a company founded by women for women, and prices range from classic to statement to completely original pieces. Orate's gold feels substantial, and their diamonds sparkle brilliantly. And because it's all real gold, you can wear it to sleep, cook, shower, or do anything really. I loved my first Orate ring so much, I went back and bought myself the Arc ring, which is stunning, and I've gotten so many compliments on it. All Orate pieces come with a lifetime warranty because they are confident their jewelry lasts. Orate was founded on the passion to shake up the jewelry market by offering modern women beautiful designs with amazing quality at affordable prices. Because Orate sells directly to you with no middleman, they can offer the same quality as traditional Fifth Avenue brands at a fraction of the cost. Orate has hacked the jewelry market, making real gold accessible for real women. You get gorgeous designs with amazing quality at actual affordable prices. For 15% off your first Orate purchase, go to orateNewYork.com/southernfried and use the promo code southernfried. That's A-U-R-A-T-E newyork.com/southernfried. And don't forget to enter the promo code southernfried to get 15% off your first beautiful Orate piece. HelloFresh is America's number one meal kit delivery service. You get seasonal recipes and pre-measured ingredients delivered right to your door. All you have to do is cook and enjoy. There is something for everyone with HelloFresh, from family recipes to calorie smart and vegetarian. HelloFresh also has fun menu series like Hall of Fame and Kraft Burgers. You can say goodbye to endless grocery store trips and takeout food. HelloFresh has got you covered. HelloFresh also gets you out of the dinner rut with 20-plus seasonal chef-curated recipes each week. I don't have to spend hours in the kitchen because with the HelloFresh step-by-step recipes and pre-measured ingredients, I can get a delicious dinner on the table in about 30 minutes. I just made the barbecue chicken tacos for my family the other day, and they were a huge hit. I'm excited to try the wasabi zinger salmon next. And HelloFresh is super convenient. You can easily change your delivery days, food preferences, and skip a week whenever you need to. For a limited time only, get 9 free meals with HelloFresh. Go to HelloFresh.com/southernfried9 and enter promo code southernfried9. Again, to get 9 free meals for a limited time, go to HelloFresh.com/southernfried9. On Monday, November 21st, Mark Walker got up early and was at work at 6:30 a.m. Around 6:45, Jill went into Emma's room to wake her up. She said her name, which would usually rouse the girl, but Emma didn't move. She touched her leg. Emma still didn't move. Then Jill looked at Emma's face and knew something was wrong. She checked her pulse but couldn't find one. She frantically called 911. but it was too late. 16-year-old Emma Jane Walker was gone. The police who were called to the scene were told it was a possible suicide. But when they searched Emma's room, they found two bullet holes in the wall and two shell casings outside the house. This was definitely no suicide. It was a one-story house, and the bullet holes were about shoulder high. There was also a bullet embedded in her pillow, but the bullet that killed her had struck just behind her left ear. Emma had been killed by a gunshot wound to her head after someone had fired two bullets into her bedroom from outside of the house. And of course, we know Riley knew exactly where Emma's bed was. He had climbed through her window before. Police sealed off the scene, and the devastated Walkers had to leave as they investigated. After finding out Emma was dead, Riley went on social media to mourn her. Riley's mother supposedly broke the news to him. In a tweet, Riley said, "Rest easy now, sweetheart. I love you forever and always." Another tweet said, "I love you, Emma. I can't be around any of that yet. It's too soon. I know you know I'm dying to be there, but understand I can't. I love you." He also wrote, "There's not a human on earth that can make the impact that you've had on my life. I miss you more than anything. You'll weigh heavy on my mind for the rest of my life because no one can fill the void that's in my heart now." Someone preserved these tweets from his account with a screenshot because soon, Riley's Twitter account was scrubbed. When talking with the police, Emma's father, Mark, said that he had heard what he thought was a door slamming in the night. He got up and checked on Emma, but she looked fine. She looked like she was sleeping peacefully. The gunshot was not visible. He had no way of knowing. A neighbor told police that they thought they heard two shots at around 2:30 a.m. Police asked Emma's friends and family who would want to hurt her. Everyone said Riley Gall. The lead detective on the case told the show 2020, quote, "Everybody kept giving us the name Riley Gall because of their relationship, because they had seen the way that Riley had treated her, the way he'd talked to her." Her shocked and grief-stricken friends held a candlelight vigil at Central High that night. And at the next football game, Emma's fellow cheerleaders released balloons in her memory. Police soon learned about the mysterious man in black who went to Emma's house on November 19th. After hearing about this man, they began to wonder if there was another suspect in addition to Riley that they should be looking into. But they didn't need to look into that man for long. Riley's friends very quickly cooperated with the investigation. Alex McCarty and Noah Walton told the police that Riley had shown them his grandfather's gun a few days before Emma was killed. Alex told 2020, quote, "He ended up telling me he was so fearful for his life that he had stolen his grandfather's gun and he showed it to me. He reassured me over and over again that he was the farthest thing from suicidal. He was just so scared of these people who were out to get him and were out to get Emma." So Riley was using the fake kidnapping incident to explain why he had a gun. But he had made a mistake showing it to his friends. He also called Noah Walton at 12:30 a.m. on the morning that Emma was found dead and asked him if he knew how to remove fingerprints from a gun. He told Noah he was asking for his roommate. Noah told ABC News that he told his friend, quote, "Obviously not, and don't ever ask me anything like that again." He said Riley knew it was a weird question and assured him he was just asking for his roommate. After hearing this, the police interviewed Riley the same day Emma was found dead. When they first arrived to speak with him, he tried to act like he didn't know Emma was dead. One investigator said something like, "Sorry about Emma," and Riley said, "What do you mean?" The detective said, "She's gone," and Riley said, "Where did she go?" Riley Gall was interrogated for 2 hours, and as he did, he kept referring to Emma as the girl, rather than by her name. When a detective would press him and ask him which girl, Riley would say the one that passed away. The detectives that interacted with Riley said that he didn't show much passion or concern. He seemed emotionless and disconnected. Investigators also thought his answers sounded rehearsed. They asked Riley to explain what he had been doing for the previous 72 hours. He told the detectives he thought he had spent the night at his friend Noah Walton's house, which, since the investigators had already talked to Noah, they knew was a lie. Riley said he had been trying to talk to, quote, the girl all weekend, but she wouldn't talk to him. But then Riley said the girl needed help and said she would talk to Riley if he would help her write a paper, so he used his friend's phone to call her on Sunday night. Riley said the phone call didn't go very well. Quote, she just told me a bunch of cruel stuff and she blocked the number. After the phone call, Riley claimed he went to his grandparents' house and then went back to the college where he said he broke down and cried for hours over their breakup. Then the police asked Riley about his grandfather's gun. They said they knew he had shown it to his friends. Riley claimed he didn't have the gun. He didn't know where it was, he hadn't shown it to his friends, and he didn't ask Noah how to remove fingerprints. Before the interview was over, police asked Riley if they could see his cell phone. At that point, Riley asked if he was a suspect, and the detective replied with, "Should you be?" But Riley insisted he had nothing to do with Emma's murder, and he didn't hand over his phone. But the police would soon get a warrant anyway. When Riley's interview with the police was over, he texted Alex McCarty and asked him why he had told the police about his grandfather's gun. Alex replied that if Riley had nothing to hide, he should show the police the gun. Alex also said he thought Riley was going to use the gun to shoot himself. Riley said, quote, I didn't fucking kill her. I would never hurt her. He also asked Alex not to talk to the police anymore. Alex later said Riley was frantic about getting caught. He said that Riley told him, quote, the only thing we can do is I'll just have to get rid of it. I have to get rid of the gun in order for me to not get pinned for something I didn't do. In order for me to not go to jail for something that I didn't do. I have to get rid of this weapon. Alex said that's when he knew his friend had murdered Emma. Alex and Noah were convinced that Riley was going to dispose of the gun before the police could get to it. They decided to talk to the police to see what they could do. Meanwhile, the police had discovered that the bullets used to kill Emma were from a 9mm handgun, the same type of gun as Riley's grandfather's. Forensic investigators needed the gun to make a match to the bullets. The police talked to Alex and Noah about how dangerous it was for them to try to get the gun back from Riley, but these kids insisted that they wanted to help no matter what. On Tuesday, November 22nd, the day after Emma was found dead, Alex and Noah wore wires so that police could listen in, and they had a small video camera hidden in a key fob. They had set up a sting on their friend. They called Riley and invited him over to play video games. While he was there, Riley again insisted he did not kill Emma, and he wanted Alex and Noah to tell the police that they had been drunk or high on LSD when they made those statements. Alex and Noah played along and apologized for talking to the cops. They told Riley they didn't know they would get him into trouble. It wasn't long after Riley got there that he asked his friends to go for a ride to the Bluffs. It was a wooded area near the Tennessee River where the kids went to drink and smoke pot. Riley wanted to throw his grandfather's gun in the river. Alex and Noah again said, "Why don't you just give the gun to the police? If Riley was innocent, he should have nothing to worry about." But Riley said no, quote, it just needs to be gone. So all three guys got into Alex's car and drove to Riley's stepfather's house. Riley had hidden the gun in the basement there, but he wouldn't let Alex or Noah go inside with him. He came back to the car with a trash bag full of stuff, including the gun. Alex and Noah asked to see the gun again, but Riley said no. Alex and Noah tried to act as normal as possible. They even stopped for fast food on the way to the Bluffs. But what Riley didn't know was that Alex and Noah were in a group text with the police, who were following behind them in three undercover vehicles. They parked in an apartment complex parking lot. Riley put on gloves, and the guys later said he was meticulous about pulling everything out of the trash bag. Finally, Riley pulled out the gun. Noah immediately texted the code word to the police group text, signaling that he saw the gun. Within 90 seconds, the police surrounded the car. 18-year-old Riley Gall was pulled out of the car and arrested. Noah later said that Riley was freaking out, cursing, and saying, "I can't go to jail. I can't go to jail." Inside the trash bag, police found the gun, gloves, tennis shoes, black tape, and black clothing. They believe the black clothing was used on the night of Emma's murder. They also believe the clothing was what the man in black was wearing the Saturday morning he was banging on Emma's door. It was already pretty obvious that Riley was the mysterious man in black. But now they had found the actual clothes. Riley was charged with first-degree murder and 6 other felony charges: aggravated stalking, theft, tampering with evidence, reckless endangerment, employing a firearm during a dangerous felony, and felony murder. Riley's family was able to post his $1 million bond, and he was monitored by a GPS ankle bracelet until his trial. Emma's funeral was held 3 days later on November 26, 2016, at Central Baptist Church of Fountain City. During the investigation, police learned from the medical examiner that while he could not determine if Emma died instantly, he was fairly sure that she was unconscious when the bullet hit her. And she probably never opened her eyes after that. At least we can hope that, and hope that she did not lay there suffering as her parents slept in a room nearby. Since her father looked in on her and thought she was sleeping, I don't think she ever woke or knew what hit her. Detectives believed that Riley knew exactly where to shoot in order to kill Emma. He positioned himself in the fenced-in backyard of the home on Cardendale Drive. He was around 4 to 5 feet from the back of the house when he fired the bullets. Phone records also showed that Riley was in the Knoxville area until around 3:45 a.m. Then he got to Maryville College around 4:19 a.m. Riley's roommate said Riley got into their dorm room at around 4:45 and then went to sleep. Just a couple of hours later, Riley's roommate woke him up to go to class. And right after that, Riley got a call from his mother saying Emma had been hurt. Riley Gall's trial began on May 1, 2018, in Knox County. The prosecution's case was that Riley planned to kill Emma because he was mad Emma ended their relationship. Riley Gall's trial began on May 1, 2018, in Knox County. The prosecution's case was that Riley planned to kill Emma because he was mad Emma ended their relationship. They said he staged the kidnapping and showed up at Emma's doorstep as the mysterious man in black, setting up an imaginary man ahead of time as the person who would eventually kill Emma. In opening arguments, the lead prosecutor said, quote, "He was possessive. He was manipulative. He was controlling. He was toxic to her. His plan was to get away with this. His plan was to never get caught." The prosecution detailed how manipulative Riley was, with his threats of suicide, his fake kidnapping, and the anonymous threatening text messages. He wasn't just manipulative. He was terrorizing Emma. The prosecution told the jury exactly what Riley did on November 21st, 2016. Riley called his friend Noah Walton and asked how to remove fingerprints from a gun. Then he left Maryville College at around 12:30 a.m. and drove to Emma's house. Once at Emma's, he stood outside her bedroom window and fired 2 shots into the wall with his grandfather's stolen 9mm gun. He knew exactly where to shoot in order to hit Emma. One shot went into a wall parallel to the side of Emma's bed, hitting her behind the ear. And the second shot went into a wall parallel to Emma's headboard. The second shot hit a wooden stud in the wall and never made its way into Emma's sleeping body. And then Riley Gall went back to his dorm room and went to sleep. Riley's defense attorney surprised everyone by arguing that instead of first-degree murder, Riley should be found guilty of reckless homicide. Though he had initially pled not guilty, Riley was now not denying he shot at Emma's house. His attorney claimed Riley only wanted to scare Emma. He said he fired the gun to get her attention, not believing the bullets would go through the wall. The defense claimed he wanted Emma to run back to him, like she had when the mysterious man in black showed up at her house. The defense also said that Riley was not the mysterious man in black. His attorney claimed that Riley shot at Emma's house, hoping to scare her so he could come to her rescue again, so he could be her hero. Riley himself did not take the stand. The jury deliberated for 5 hours. On May 8, 2018, Riley was found guilty of first-degree murder, stalking, theft, reckless endangerment, tampering with evidence, and being in possession of a firearm during a dangerous felony. He was automatically given a life sentence, with a possibility of parole after 51 years for the murder charge. On September 14, 2018, Riley was sentenced for the other charges. He received 29 days for the misdemeanor stalking charge, 1 year for theft, and 3 years each for the rest of the charges. The sentences will run concurrently with his life sentence. At Riley's sentencing, Emma's mother Jill said, "You ended her life. No punishment will ever bring Emma back. But what helps is knowing that he can't do this to anyone else." Riley spoke at his sentencing and said, "I'm sorry I took Emma away from you, that I robbed you of the experience of watching your daughter grow up. What I can do is tell the truth about that night. I wanted to scare her. I never meant to take Emma's life. Again, I am sorry." Riley Gall is incarcerated in the Northwest Correctional Complex in Tiptonville, Tennessee. He is not eligible for parole until November 19, 2077, when he will be 79 years old. For what it's worth, many people did believe in Riley's defense. Even if they think he was the man in black, they still believe he was only trying to scare Emma. Also, one of the listeners who suggested this case questioned how it could be first-degree murder. Wouldn't he have to be standing beside Emma, holding the gun to her head, for it to be first-degree murder and not reckless homicide? Proving first-degree murder is all about intent. Because police believed that Riley knew exactly where to stand to shoot Emma from the outside of her home, they believed that proved intent. The prosecution agreed, and so did the jury. But I won't lie, I do believe it's possible he was trying to scare her. He was desperate to win her back, and he was successful in his first attempt as the scary man in black intruder in getting Emma to call for him. She did go to him when she was scared. If that is true, it's more manipulation, more coercive control. "You can't live without me. You need me." But a lot of planning went into shooting Emma that night. Riley stole the gun from his grandfather 4 days prior to Emma's murder. The next day after stealing the gun, he tried the man in black scheme. It backfired when Emma's mother showed up. Maybe that was a last-ditch effort to get her to come back to him. Maybe he was already planning the second step in scaring Emma by shooting at her house. And maybe he really did mean to kill her. The most dangerous time for victims of domestic abuse is when they leave. Experts say that could be within hours of leaving to 4 months later. Emma Walker had been breaking up with Riley Gall constantly for months before her parents finally grounded her, effectively ending the toxic relationship. And while the abuse was not physical, it was still abuse. Coercive control is the cornerstone of abusive relationships. It's emotional abuse. British domestic violence expert and podcaster Laura Richards says, quote, "Abuse is a pattern, a war of attrition that wears a person down." That sounds exactly what Riley was doing to Emma. England and Wales passed the first coercive control laws in 2015. Ireland and Scotland passed similar laws this year in January and April of 2019. Laura Richards worked to help pass the British law after working for 2 decades as a criminal behavioral analyst in domestic abuse. She says coercive control is at the very heart of domestic violence. So far, only New York has attempted to pass a similar law here in the United States. It has passed the state senate, but is still sitting in a committee and has not gone to the assembly yet. The next step, after it passes the assembly, is for the governor to sign it into law. We need to start advocating for a federal coercive control law. And in the meantime, pray that other states follow New York's lead. Ironically, it was actually an American forensic social worker named Evan Stark who coined the phrase coercive control in his book, Coercive Control: How Men Entrap Women in Personal Life. In 1977, he founded one of the U.S.'s first battered women's shelters in New Haven, Connecticut. But the Violence Against Women Act was not passed into law until 1994. Evan Stark's book was cited by English and Welsh policymakers when establishing their coercive control laws. He now believes that the movement to create laws to protect domestic abuse victims in the U.S. dropped the ball by not considering coercive control. At the time, he and other activists were so consumed with getting women to report the physical abuse that they didn't see the other side of it. For years, women told them that the violence was not the worst part. It was the constant control of their daily lives. It was the feelings of helplessness and how it damaged their self-esteem, causing depression, PTSD, and other psychological problems. According to endcoercivecontrol.org, criminalizing this form of intimate partner violence would send a powerful message to society. It would give victims more confidence to come forward earlier, and that leads to early intervention and prevention. Emma Walker's mother, Jill, hopes that Emma's death helps others identify abusive relationships. She said, quote, "If your boyfriend or girlfriend is telling you you can't go there or what to wear or who to hang out with or who to talk to, it's not okay. I think when they become quiet and withdrawn, it's a big sign too. It's not just bruises. It's emotional and controlling." NPR published an article about a new study that found that of the more than 2,000 adolescents murdered between 2003 and 2016, nearly 7%, 150 teens, were killed by their current or former intimate partners. 90% of the victims were female, and their average age was around 17 years old. In almost 80% of cases, the perpetrator was 18 years or older. Riley was 18, and Emma was 16. When we're older, 2 years doesn't seem like much of an age difference. But for teenagers, that can be an extreme imbalance of power. And sadly, girls between the ages of 16 and 24 are about 3 times more likely than the rest of the population to be victims of domestic violence. Emma Walker had big dreams. She loved children and animals. She wanted to be a NICU nurse. After her death, a NICU patient room at East Tennessee Children's Hospital was named after Emma, and a Knoxville dog park was renamed the Emma Jane Walker Memorial Dog Park. These are lovely tributes to a life cut so tragically short. Emma suffered emotional abuse for 2 years before her death. Experts call that murder in slow motion, which is so incredibly heartbreaking. Southern Fried True Crime is written and produced by me, Erica Kelly. The original graphic art is by Coley Horner, and Southern Fried's original music is by Rob Harrison of Gamma Radio. Special thanks to Haley Gray for her diligent research on this case. And thank you to Justin Ray and Melissa Reed for suggesting Emma's case. If you or someone you know is suffering with intimate partner abuse in the United States, please call the Domestic Violence Hotline at 1-800-799-7233. Services for the UK, Australia, and Canada are listed in today's show notes. I've got a YouTube channel up and going. It's in its early stages, but I'm really proud of the work my friend Stephanie Janelle has been doing for the channel. It's youtube.com/Southern Fried True Crime. If you enjoyed today's show, don't forget to subscribe, and please tell a friend or rate and review on iTunes. I'm also on most large platforms like Stitcher and Spotify. If you're interested in supporting the show, please visit my website, southernfriedtruecrime.com. There you can sign up to be a patron of the show, make a one-time donation, or purchase show merchandise. That's southernfriedtruecrime.com. If you have any case suggestions, please email southernfriedtruecrime@gmail.com and please include a name or a link to an article. Private messages on social media get lost, so email is best. And please feel free to reach out. I love hearing from you guys. Until next time, thanks so much for listening. Y'all take care.